Hopkins' novel of One Blood is a curiously utopian work. Serialised in the coloured American magazine between 1902 and 1903, whilst Hopkins worked as editor, the text is notable for its odd generic mixings and appropriation of numerous sources. Some of these were acknowledged, as in the case of William James's The Hidden Self from 1890, which serves as the novel's subtitle, but many more were actually unattributed. Its fantastic Back to Africa plot rejects the highbrow realism associated with Edith Wharton and Henry James and introduces black speculative fiction more than 20 years before George Schuller had published Black No More in 1931. And yet it shouldn't be read literally as a narrative promoting repatriation, but rather as part of a broader editorial and authorial practice in which Hopkins was trying to promote black consciousness. Critics refer to Of One Blood as unruly, escapist, anti-realist, or at least distinguished by its use of what Valerie Rohe calls literary unrealism, frequently commenting on its generic experimentation in mixing numerous popular genres, and these include the Bildungsroman, the melodrama, sentimental and gothic fiction with its love triangles, its incest and miscegenation, popular anxieties in Victorian-era fiction, and also the colonial African adventure narrative and the associated lost race narrative, as well as the centrally embedded African utopia in which an ancient Ethiopian city is discovered with its superior civilization and its technological supremacy far in advance of contemporary post-Reconstruction America. Hopkins is ambivalent in her treatment of literary genre. On the one hand, then, she mixes so-called modern turn-of-the-century realism with older non-realist forms, and in particular, critics have noted the Freudian Unheimlich that animates gothic tropes of temporal disturbances, uncanny returns, but also melodramas and romantic adventure. As Rohe puts it then, the novel abundantly defies the laws of realism, and we might understand this as a necessary utopian strategy to retrieve and recuperate black life from the disorganising effects of slavery, as Jolondra A. Davis has written. So this kind of generic discontinuity can productively be read alongside Hopkins' appropriation of numerous contemporary sources, I think, as a politicised strategy of appropriation, and particularly in terms of not attributing white sources. And this is something that Ira Dworkin calls archival revenge. So in addition to borrowing from popular white periodicals, such as Frank Leslie's Popular Monthly and Scribner's magazine, and this was during her tenure as editor of the coloured American magazine, Pauline Hopkins extensively cited numerous sources in Of One Blood. Scholars have recently uncovered extensive and frequently wholesale inclusion of unattributed sources. So, for example, more than 300 words were lifted from John Harley Coombs's book about Dr. Livingstone, Dr. Livingstone's 17 Years Explorations and Adventures in the Wilds of Africa, published in 1857. They've also noted material borrowed from H. Rider Haggard's She, A History of Adventure, published in 1887, and Rudyard Kipling's The Nolaka from 1892. Given Kipling's fiercely protective stance towards his copyrighted works, as well as Pauline Hopkins' own attentiveness to copyright law. So she'd been filing copyright applications for all of her work since she was a teenager, and in many cases this was several years before she'd even written the works, or at least completed them. So I don't think this is a naive dismissal of copyright law. I think she was very aware of copyright law herself. I think then there seems to be sufficient evidence to claim that her practice of textual poaching in Of One Blood is actually part of a sophisticated praxis of critiquing literary ownership at a time when, as Dworkin suggests, Emersonian ideals of collective authorship were giving way to the codification of the text as individual property. Meanwhile, and perhaps even more interestingly than these unattributed borrowings of other people's sources, she excludes contemporary Orientalist sources within the corpus of exploration narratives. So one example is Henry Morton Stanley, whose reputation as a brutal imperialist and colonial agent was established by the time she was writing in 1902 to 1903. So I suppose one question is, might we reconsider Of One Blood then as a modernist experiment in literary illusion akin to Joyce's Ulysses or Eliot's The Wasteland? And paying attention to these non-citational practices changes how we read the text. In this paper, I'd like to consider how her politicised generic and citational innovations might help us rethink the novel's place within literary utopian studies, and particularly in terms of decolonising the white literary utopia through two particular aspects of the novel, which I'll just sketch out, hopefully, in the space of this paper. So the first of which, then, is this centrally embedded African utopia of Telesar, which functions as a speculative location for domestic projects of racial uplift and pan-African notions of global blackness through positing a pre-apocalyptic, pre-slavery space of black dignity. And I guess the second aspect I'd like to think about is to ask, what are we supposed to make of the strange temporalities of this black utopian space of possibility, given that its privileging of an Ethiopian ancestral homeland looks backward to ancient sort of antiquity? Is this simply a cyclical historical return in which African originary greatness has been lost and might one day be restored via a black messianic figure? Or is something more temporally dislocating actually going on here? So in Of One Blood, Hopkins establishes an alternative continuity via Ethiopianism, an early strand of black nationalist discourse that took its inspiration from Psalms 68:31. And the quote is, "Princes shall come out of Egypt, Ethiopia shall soon stretch forth her hands unto God," end quote. This prophecy of the return of an ancient black civilization that predates classical antiquity then offers a powerful rejoinder to the Teutonic Whig theory of history, as critics have referred to it, in which the Teutonic tribes that vanquished Rome were supposed to have transmitted democratic structures to England via the Saxon invasion before then being transplanted over into New England in the New World. And moreover, in the process of this kind of rejoinder to a sort of Whig Teutonic theory of history, we also have the subversion of generic frameworks. As Laura Dale suggests, Atlantic Gothic, for instance, offers Hopkins a narrative whose terms are not her own, but which nonetheless provide her a point of entry, and in so doing helps her to critique contemporary racial discourse. Similarly, Mandy A. Reed has talked about Hopkins's novel in a comparative analysis with the black ethnology, that's the bad one, right? The worst one, that's the bad one, of Martin R. Delaney, the African-American scientist and journalist, and specifically his 1879 Principia of Ethnology. And Reed writes that it is particularly interesting that given the virulent racism often generated by racial science in the 19th century, Martin Delaney and Pauline Hopkins opted to employ the discourse of racial science in order to construct their own racial utopias. And there's quite a lot of talk about blood as well, and I had to cut that from the talk, but if anybody wants to know more about blood as a signifier for race and sort of the biology of race, then I can answer questions about that later. Okay, so for those of you who may not be familiar with the text, I thought I would sketch out some details. I'm not going to offer a close reading because it's too long. But let's start with the novel's hero, Ruel Briggs. He's characterised by three things: his melancholic disposition, appropriate to a man of scientific talent so prodigious that genius isolates him from his peers at Harvard University, where he's a medical student. His physical prowess, suggestive of noble lineage, and increasingly explicit references to his future role as the Black Messiah that come to fruition in the Central African expedition at the heart of the novel. And then thirdly, his racial ambiguity. I'll come back to that in a moment. So as an ambitious young Harvard student specializing in mesmerism and also reanimation, who anticipates Lovecraft's Herbert West by some 20 years, Briggs's almost suicidal melancholy rivals the sorrows of young Werther, although we're perhaps fortunately spared a first-person epistolary account. We always get a point of view third-person narration for Ruel. His origins then are established as a mystery right from the start. He's not only connected to insurpassable mesmeric abilities and the ability to bring people back almost from the dead, but he is rumoured to be of Italian birth, and then students, quote, guessed that he was a Japanese. So we find out, spoiler alert, right at the end of the novel, that he has in fact been passing as white, as have other characters in the novel, when he is actually of ancient Ethiopian lineage, and he is in fact black. So initially on the African expedition, Briggs surveys the African landscape with colonial dismissal. Travelling from Tripoli, quote, the capital of a truly barbaric state, by camel across the Libyan desert, he confirms his natural abilities for heroism and leadership by shooting a leopard to save the life of his friend, before then condemning the landscape to the distant past. Quote, here there was no future, no railroads, no churches, no saloons, no schoolhouses to echo the voices of merry children, no promise of the life that produces within the range of his vision. Nothing but the monotony of past dead centuries, dead and forgotten, save by a few learned savants. End quote. In this scene, we can see Hopkins's appropriation of the historical figure of David Livingstone in the service of a fictional discourse about African-American travel. Like Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, the bishop of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, who had made several trips to Africa in the 1890s that were widely discussed in the African-American press, Hopkins mediates between colonial and African-American perspectives in constructing her narrative of travel into the African interior. Not only does this synthesize discursive traditions of travel writing, and it's worth bearing in mind that Hopkins herself had not traveled to Africa, but it also appropriates European imperialist discourse, which sees the landscape as empty, uninhabitable, and beset by savagery. And in so doing, then, she reclaims the power of knowledge production about African travel for her black readership that she was building up through her editorial and activist work in Boston for the Coloured American magazine. So the expedition is led by a professor who tries to convince his students, and they struggle to accept this hypothesis, that an ancient Ethiopian race has predated Egyptian civilization and therefore demonstrates a prehistoric existence of black magnificence. It is hard to believe your story, says one of the group. From what a height must this people have fallen to reach the abjectness of the American Negro? Hopkins' omniscient narrator follows this scene with a moment of overt narrative intrusion, a pause in story time, to quote the French abolitionist and philosopher Volney. And the quote is, how are we astonished when we reflect that to the race of Negroes, the object of our extreme contempt, we owe our arts, sciences, and even the use of speech. But crucially, she does this through the figure of Ruel Briggs, the black messianic protagonist, whose own post-slavery subjectivity and black masculinity is achieved at the expense of his love interest, Dianth, who also turns out to be his sister, because it's a narrative of incest in the best kind of sentimental style. As Jalondra Davis has said then, the speculative black utopian narrative that confirms his Afrotopian dignity at the same time naturalizes heteropatriarchy, and this exploits Dianth, a black woman whose reproductive body has become the focus of New Negro thought as a result of its antebellum sexual and reproductive exploitation. A black woman who is rescued from near death and also suffers amnesia after a railway accident, and who from that moment on, at the beginning of the narrative, doesn't know her own identity because Ruel goes to great lengths to hide it from her, and who is also herself a disabled woman from that point on in the story. So, you know, he might be the black masculine subject with his own post-slavery subjectivity, but he is exploiting her in some very cruel and sort of misogynist ways. Okay, so let's think a bit then about the temporality of Afrotopia. With the Jim Crow racial segregation laws, intellectuals like Pauline Hopkins took their inspiration from biblical references to Ethiopia, which, as Cedric Tolliver notes, offered them both evidence of a glorious black past and a herald of the race's future redemption. Stumbling past a Sphinx statue secreted deep inside an ancient pyramid, Ruel loses consciousness when he's captured by the black utopian citizens of the hidden city of Telesar. He awakes to a utopian scene of palatial splendour. I never get bored of these, but I know a lot of people find them really dull. But this includes things like silk cushions, perfumed air, fluted columns in a vast marble chamber, gorgeous plumed birds, stunning stained glass and repasts of fruit, game and wine, delicious languor, and so on. And when he wakes up, he's then astonished to see the beauty of the black utopians. Quote, "The faces into which he gazed were perfect in the cut and outline of every feature. The forms hidden by soft white drapery, Grecian in effect, were athletic and beautifully moulded." End of quote. Literary utopian studies has a lot of work to do in terms of decolonising its central objects of study. The genre's most prolific period, from roughly the 1880s to about 1915, privileged advanced industrialisation of the economic and productive mechanisms that would, inevitably, lead to more efficient and rationalised societies, would eliminate poverty and disease, and liberate workers into automated futures of post-scarcity abundance. This imaginary shares with Marxist telos-oriented visions of revolutionary rupture a linear narrative of historical progress that entirely overlooks the systemic racial violence structurally embedded within capitalism in its imperial stage. It is only, in fact, very recently that scholars have even begun to consider the anti-black racism that has plagued literary utopias since the inception of the term in 1516 with Thomas More's eponymous text. As the Jamaican novelist and critic Sylvia Winter puts it, the white utopia of industrial progress was a black inferno. And indeed, the inequalities of the so-called blueprint utopias were clear from the start. More's King Utopus relied upon slave labour to build his island, which retained a penal system of indentured servitude, enslaved prisoners of war, and employed the use of colonies to help regulate population on the island. Meanwhile, notable feminist utopian texts such as Mary E. Bradley Lane's Mizora and Charlotte Perkins Gilman's Herland eliminated women of colour from their utopian enclaves and have been scrutinised in utopian scholarship for their eugenicist visions. Okay, I may have to skip a little because I'm aware of time. So, the novel, then, I think, can be identified as redeeming a repressed black utopian tradition, which, as Alex Zamelin reminds us in his 2019 book Black Utopia, has in fact been present all along. Quote, "A utopian kernel was indeed lodged at the beginning of the black experience. This utopian strain of hope is evident, based on what are arguably the three pillars of African-American political thought, liberation, justice, and freedom," end quote. In the runaway maroon slave colonies or all-black towns, such as Mound Bayou in the Mississippi Delta, which was founded by ex-slaves in 1887, Zamelin then identifies intentional black communities whose utopian strain of hope can be traced back through African-American political thought. So from these slave colonies, through the prophetic faith of the spirituals, all black towns founded by ex-slaves, black nationalist discourse, and also black intellectuals writing speculative or fantasy literature, including Sutton E. Griggs, Francis Harper, Pauline Hopkins, and Edward A. Johnson, right through into the extraterrestrial visions of Afrofuturist musicians such as Sun Ra, most famously, artists, performers, and writers. Black utopias have carved out alternative spaces and times of hope, even when black despair predominated. So I'd just like to say a few things about the temporalities then of this Afrotopia, and this will build to my conclusion, and I'll do it via a quick detour through the idea of apocalypticism in black aesthetics, because I think this can help us establish why and how this particular novel might decolonise the white literary utopia. In her 2018 book, A Billion Black Anthropocenes or None, the inhuman geologist, Catherine Yusuf, that's her actual title, considers that, that's not a judgment, if anything, I'm impressed that she's so inhuman. She considers the suspension of time as a recurring trope within black aesthetics. Steve McQueen's film Caribs Leap Western Deep from 2011, for example, presents two moments of suicidal escape and collective resistance. One is in Grenada in 1651, the other is in a contemporary South African gold mine. And both of them are suspended, as it were, in midair. She writes, "We see the figures always in mid-flight, never jumping or landing, but suspended in an endless, ever-falling body, gently held by the atmosphere. These figures defy gravity," end quote. In the proximity between the black body and inhuman materials, particularly coal, oil, gas, fossil fuel extraction, and so on, a potential emerges for what Tiffany King calls black fungibility in her analysis of plantation landscapes. Rather than discrete human bodies, this black fungibility recognises the instability and the process of black bodies denied full humanity, and the latent power that resides in their more than human relationships with plants, objects, and other life forms, which cleave apart a site of deferral or escape from the current entrapments of the human. She relates this idea to a painting, and I don't think I've got time to find an image for you, but I'll just have to describe it. It's an 1817 print by an unknown printmaker that's held at Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington. And it was featured in an exhibition called Making a Way Out of No Way. And in it, in this engraving, a woman jumps out of, a fourth story window in an attempt to escape slavery by committing suicide. But she seemingly defies gravity in the image, and it was inspired by a real-life story. Scholars who've analysed the image suggest that this woman is somehow outside of time and outside of temporal flow. In the geophysics of this image of the suspended woman, Yusuf writes, gravity is both the problem and the solution, rendering her invulnerable, held in the possible, awaiting a different tense of being, a different future. And it's also analysed by Tina Camp, who's got a fantastic book on black futurity in photographic images. And Tina Camp talks about the kind of the tense in which this woman is suspended. She said it performs a future that hasn't yet happened but must. It shows the power to imagine beyond current fact and to envision that which is not, i.e. that she might survive the fall, that she might never need to jump in the first place. It's a politics of prefiguration that involves living the future now as an imperative rather than a striving for the future that you would want to see. So I've been working a bit on this idea of the future that hasn't happened yet but must, which is made visible through this black speculative act of temporal arrest, and which I think if we try and apply it to Pauline Hopkins's novel, suggests something a bit more complicated than simply a cyclical return to ancient Ethiopian mythology as the guarantor of black dignity in the future via, the messianic arrival of Ruel Briggs. And I think it could be considered an example of what I've elsewhere theorised as non-contemporaneity, a utopian temporal formulation which holds the unredeemed historical potential, from failed revolutionary attempts in the past, understood here in terms similar to Walter Benjamin's tragic pessimism and Ernst Bloch's ontology of hope, but also alongside a materially embodied set of futural actualities that are already gelid within the present moment. And just to conclude then, I think Cedric Tolliver's analysis of Hopkins' critique of institutional racism in American history, which he traces through the novel Of One Blood, is actually really interesting and raises some points of convergence maybe with Mike's paper on Lovecraft. Okay, so he argues then that in the Ethiopian section of the novel, the way in which it's structurally framed and presented appropriates attempts by white professional historians in the late 19th century to connect American civic institutions with Teutonic and Anglo-Saxon origins, and thereby, in doing so, they establish this mythologized continuity between feudal German villages and the New England towns in which they were writing. So I think paying attention then to Pauline Hopkins' subversive tactics of historical appropriation, of trying to take the narrative structures of a Teutonic Whig history, a white history, and subverting them and using them to posit her own Afrotopia of ancestral Ethiopia, perhaps conceived as an act of archival revenge, particularly when read alongside her non-citational practices, where she's just quoting chunks of material from sources that she never actually cites, might help us to reread this novel as something that Sylvia Winter calls a black counter-poetics. So like the black oral cultures of the New World, and specifically blues music, we might consider Of One Blood to construct an alternative temporal experience in which black possibility hangs suspended in midair. A time of the blues in which, as Sylvia Winter puts it, we are without climax or end. We have established time outside of European sense of time and a factory time, and blues time itself emerges as a space and a subversive territory of place, a black counterpoetics. Thank you very much.